Some of the questions I've been asked, I'm going to deal with later on when it becomes more appropriate to deal with them. But I've received a lot of good questions about plans of eating that I'd like to deal with now. I talked about it, but I didn't make it absolutely clear. Many people don't eat foods for reasons that have nothing to do with compulsive eating. And that's fine. I mean, I don't eat meat. It has nothing to do with compulsive eating. It's just I don't eat meat. And I don't count that as part of my plan of eating. If I ever somehow ate meat, I wouldn't consider myself to have broken my abstinence because it's irrelevant in terms of compulsive eating. Meat doesn't create in and of itself any problem. And those of you who may have certain allergies of the other kind, would die if you ate shrimp or die if you ate peanuts, unless you have a desire to eat peanuts despite the fact that you would die if you did, if you had that desire, then clearly it may be a problem in compulsive eating. But if you didn't have that desire, if you knew that eating peanuts would kill you and you didn't eat peanuts, that's not part of a plan of eating that makes sense in OA. What OA does is find a way, what a plan of eating in Overeaters Anonymous does, is to find a way to eliminate the foods, food ingredients, and or eating behaviors that cause you uncontrollable cravings. That's from the big book. And that's what's important. So I've asked a bunch of different questions. It's a person who says, I'm not in recovery, never have been. I imagine that all my trigger foods will be all the foods that I like, all the foods that trigger my overeating. And yes, that may be true. I can promise you that at the other end of the day, after you've worked the steps, not only will those foods Not only will you find that your ability to taste is different, and foods that you normally wouldn't like become wonderful, but you will also be repulsed by the idea of eating the foods that you used to love. So the question is leaping into the void. It's just making a decision to do it and working as quickly as possible with the steps, so that you end up with that wonderful thing where the thought of eating this food is, it's like eating rat poison or mouse poison. Why would you eat poison? And once you have reached that moment of sanity, so what if you've given up these foods? Dr. Bob said it in his own way, but I say, I have eaten all the ice cream that anyone is entitled to in his lifetime. I just ate it early, you know, and so I've had all those foods. Laurie, I've heard by some OAs have gone back to eat their compulsive foods because they're not compulsive anymore about them. What do you think about it? You know what? I'm going to save that for step 10. Just a minute. I'll come back to that. And this is the same kind of question, so I'll come back to that. Did I work the steps only once? Well, I worked steps 1 through 9 only once. Once I've recovered, I worked steps 10, 11, and 12, but I'll come back to that as well. Are you saying that one can have an allergy towards certain eating behaviors or perhaps even attitudes towards eating selfishly? Well, it's an allergic reaction. The foods cause an allergy. The foods cause this abnormal reaction or the eating behaviors. I am saying that some eating behaviors can cause an allergic reaction of craving. That's what I'm saying. And maybe eating selfishly. I'm not sure what this person means, but I imagine it's sort of like, it's all mine. I want everything. I want, you know, because I certainly have experienced that. If it's that, then yes, I would say that feeling might be an eating behavior that causes an allergy. It might be something that you can't control. And once you feel it, you do it. So you have to learn to give something up, to give it up, to eat only certain amounts or certain things. I remember when I first started, I would save a certain amount of food on my plate for my sponsor, you know, who never ate it. But. What will for you be breaking your abstinence? Well, it would be knowingly eating butter, for instance, knowingly eating ice cream, knowing that I'm eating some foods that are not on that I've eliminated. That I would be breaking my abstinence. Can you say something about the relation between cravings and the reward systems of your brain, sugar priming, etc.? I did talk about this. It may have been this. You know, I talked about the serotonin, the dopamine. There is some research on this. It's not conclusive, but certainly there's a movement among some researchers and some doctors to consider compulsive overeating an addiction. Now, I've never You know, I use Bill Wilson, who wrote the big book and other great works of AA literature, was very careful to use the word illness rather than disease in referring to alcoholism. And in English, he felt that the difference was that illness was something that a doctor would not necessarily diagnose, but disease was something that was medical. And he wanted to keep alcoholism away from the doctors. He wanted to make it and you'll see as we go on, the treatment of alcoholism, the definition of an alcoholic in the big book is different from the definition of an alcoholic in the diagnostic statistical manual, DSM. I'm sure it's used here as well. It certainly is used in the United States and Canada, that most psychiatrists or psychologists would define. The definitions of most addictions come down to a combination of frequency and amount. If you take a lot of times, and it's causing you harm, it also has to cause harm, then you are by definition an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever. And that's not the definition of the big book of the alcoholic. The definition of the big book is a person who has both an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, no matter how frequently or infrequently that person drinks, and no matter how much that person drinks. The big book says you can be a moderate drinker and still be an alcoholic. So Bill wanted to take it away from medicine, and because he didn't want it there to be a medical approach to the problem. He wanted it to be spiritual. And so I use the word illness and not disease, even though in today's world, illness and disease have almost similar meaning. So those are the questions so far that I'm going to answer. The rest of the questions I will answer. They're wonderful questions, but it isn't the time to answer them. I will, when I get to the particular point of the book, I'll discuss them. We're on to Bill's story, but I'm not going to spend much time on Bill's story. That's page one of... I'm now with the third and fourth edition. It's all the same page numbers, but it's at page 26 in the Danish version. Bill Wilson, this is Bill's story. Bill Wilson was truly a brilliant man. And his story is one that is at times difficult for people in OA to understand or to empathize with. His was a typical or stereotypical alcoholic kind of life, where he makes money, he loses money, and he drinks, and he breaks things, and you know all these things. The story I told you about yesterday, you having a business appointment on a Thursday and drinking on Wednesday and waking up in the hotel room or on the gutter on the Friday and not knowing where you'd been. These are the sort of the typical stories that the first edition of the big book contained. They were the gutter drunks, the street drunks. And sometimes it's hard to see in him the kind of the gradual deterioration, the loneliness and the despair that many of us feel, because many of us in our program feel and have been victims of people like Bill, actually. We've been hurt. We've been really hurt by other people who have been more active and taking greater risks and taking greater liberties with emotions and because of their own addictions. So it's sometimes hard to read Bill's story, and I'm not going to spend much time on it other than to tell you that the elements of the illness are right in his story. He starts off with talking about alcohol as being something that gives him creativity, that gives him conviviality, he calls it, that gives him friendship, that he's able to loosen up and be more creative. But gradually it becomes a necessity to him, and he realizes that he can't do without it. And he realizes that that's bad. He keeps trying to swear off. His wife is his codependent, Lois, who helped him a lot in his illness, and she admitted it, and that's why she was the founder of Al-Anon. She helped him and did everything for him, and just thought that love could overcome his alcoholism. Of course, it could not, and that was one of her greatest sadnesses, and one of the things she talks about in her own memoirs about the founding of Al-Anon and her realization that she thought she could fix him. And of course, that's many of us understand that feeling in our lives. So Bill talks about this, and it's all wonderful, incredible stories, which he talks about in detail in other books and articles that he's written. Familiar story. It's prohibition time in the United States. You can't get alcohol other than illegally. And he has signed. He's been penniless for years. His wife works, and she cleans the house, and she does the dishes, and she does the laundry. And he just sits there and drinks. That's the way women were in those days, I suppose. But she was the one who brought in the money. But he had a chance to make money. But they knew he was a drunk, so they made him sign a contract that said, if you have a drink before the time we sign the final, we're creating a company, and the company, you'd be president of the company, but until we create it, you can't have a drink. And it was 2 days before this company was about to be created. He's in a hotel room, and someone comes up with a jug, you know, a big jug of, he says, boys, this is Applejack whiskey from Tennessee. It's great stuff. You can't get it here. Have some on me. So the jug goes around, and Bill, they offer to Bill, oh, I don't drink. I'm not drinking. Passes around a second time. I don't drink. Passes around a third time, and the man says, you know, Bill, this is, you can't get this here. It's a different kind of whiskey. Okay. Bang. You know, and that's a story we all know. At least I know. I know it well. You can't get this anywhere else, and therefore it's a good reason to try it. So there's an example of all the times he tried to stop and he couldn't. There's another story, a long story, which I won't tell you about, where he explains to a person for 3 hours why he cannot have so much as one drink, and then someone gives him a free beer and he drinks it in front of that other person. And I understand that. I mean, it's happened to me many times. I don't know if you have stories here where people give out samples, but, well, I know you do. I went to a market and I had there were samples there. And, you know, you say, oh, it's free. Why not? And then you suddenly realize, my God, what have I done? I've just had something I shouldn't be having. But the important thing, there are a couple of important things. On page 7 of the big book of the English version and D31, D is Danish, page 31 of the Danish book, Bill talks about being put into a hospital where he met a kind doctor. This was Dr. Silkworth. And he learned that his problem was, as Dr. Silkworth described, the allergy of the body, the obsession of mind. It wasn't his fault. He had an illness. And he knew now he could no longer touch so much as one drop of alcohol. He thought, terrific. I now know I can't touch one drop of alcohol. And he still gets drunk. And he ends up back in the hospital that Dr. Silkworth was running, the town's hospital. And the doctor says to Lois, he's either going to die or he has to be locked up, because you will never be able to cure him. I don't know how to cure him. And he says, and this is page 8 of the big book and paragraph 2 of page 32 in the Danish version. When I say paragraph 2, I mean the second full paragraph on the page. And he says, I know it. I knew it. They were downstairs talking. I knew I was gone upstairs. And he says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass, which is a swamp, bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. This was Bill's step one. Bill knew from Dr. Silkworth now that he was doomed, because he could not stop once he started, and he also realized he couldn't stop from starting. No matter how much he knew he couldn't have a drop of alcohol, at a certain point, his mind would go blank. He'd give himself an excuse to go back and have his first drink. So he was in a vicious circle. He could not stop once he started, and he couldn't stop from starting. That was step one. And now comes in Bill's story when the violins begin to play, because he's sitting in his house, in his apartment. I can't remember if it was a house or an apartment. I should know that. And someone phones him. And it is a man named Ebenezer Thatcher. Ebby phones him. He was sober. Bill knew that Ebby was a drunk. Bill knew that Bill once said that if he ever got as bad as Ebby, he'd have to stop drinking. And yet Ebby was sober. And he wanted to come for supper. So he came for supper. And then he and Bill sat down across the kitchen table. That same kitchen table that I was sitting at in 2006 or something like that. And Bill gives him a drink. Of course, why not? You know, let him pursue, let him share in my happiness. I don't know if you've ever done that. Have you ever, in order to break your own diet, given someone else some food in order to get them started? And Ebi says, no, I'm not drinking. And Bill says, well, what's going on? And Ebi says, I've got religion. And this starts Bill off on a religious diatribe. He can't stand religion. This caused wars. This caused all kinds of problems. He doesn't believe in God. And there's a page and a half in the big book where he talks about that. And then he says, I can believe in the devil because it had me. The devil had me, but I can't believe in God. But he looks at Ebi and he says, across me sits a miracle. You know, there's a miracle that's much more important than any of the miracles talked about, say, in the Bible or something. This is a miracle in front of me. This was a man who used to drink more than I did, who no longer drinks. And that's page 11 of the big book, and paragraph 2 of page 35 of the Danish version. He had power. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at this minute, and that was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. I love this next sentence. I think it's beautifully written. Here was something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. I just think that's so well written. Something at work in the human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. But he still can't believe in God. He still can't accept a religion. And Ebi, who was a member of a particular religious group, it was a Protestant group called the Oxford Groups. I'll talk about them a bit more later on. Ebi committed, changed religion to spirituality in this one moment. Ebi said to him, why don't you try your own conception of God? And Bill realized, I can do that. I can apply my own conception. I just have to be willing to look for it. Ebi came to him with some simple tools for finding spirituality. Bill wrote about them later, and he quoted Ebi as saying this. Well, you know, Ebi said, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make up for all the wrongs you've done, you pray to God for guidance in all things, and you help other people with a hope of reward, promise, prestige, or power. You get honest with yourself, step 4. You get honest with another human being, step 5. You pray, you make up for the wrongs you've done, step 9. You pray to God for guidance, step 11. You help others without hope of reward, power, or prestige, step 12. Those were the simple steps that Ebi brought to him. And they came from the Oxford Groups, which I'll talk about in a few moments. Bill went crazy. He thought, this is something I might be able to do. He got drunk, of course, right away after that, thinking and drinking. He got drunk and he went to the church that Ebi was a part of. It was in the Bowery of New York, a very low place in those times. Now it's quite a wealthy place, but in those days it used to be the lowest of the low lived there. And it was a mission where people would stay in the church and sort of eat in the, you know, eat whatever was fed to them. And he was drunk, and Ebi tried to get him to eat something, but he wouldn't do it. He went into the church, and he made confession, and he made a big commotion. And then he went back home, and he drank, and then he decided he would see Dr. Silkworth, and he bought 4 bottles of beer to help him on the way, and he walks into the town's hospital with his 4th bottle of beer after having drunk the other 3, and he says, Dr. Silkworth, I think this time I have something. And Dr. Silkworth says, yes, you do, my boy. And he put him to dry out. After about 3 days, Bill tells his story in different ways in different places. In the big book, the way Bill tells it is he went through steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 and recovered. That's the way he tells it in the big book. He tells it in different ways in the other ones. There's a wonderful story about, if there is a God, let him come to me now, and the room fills with a white flash and stuff like that, which is, in other versions, he talks about it as happening at the equivalent of step 3. But in the big book, consistent with the big book's approach to the steps, nothing happens to him until halfway through step 9. And it's very important for us to look at the big book as a set of directions and as how consistent it is. Within the big book, Bill gets a spiritual awakening halfway through step 9, which are the promises of step 9. You will know the word serenity, and you will know the peace, and you will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door, and all those spiritual promises. And those happen to Bill in this story, in his version here, halfway through step 9. I'm not going to go into any details. I'll just point that out. We're now on chapter 2. There is a solution. Is this good? Can you hear me with this? Yeah. So page 17 of the big book and page 40 of the Danish. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. I'm told, by the way, that in Danish, the word recovered is not used. It is more a sense of being, that the only place in the Danish version that recovered is used is on the title page, where it says how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, that it says cured, actually, in this book. And, of course, the big book says we're not cured of alcoholism. We have, it says later on, we have a reprieve from our illness, a daily reprieve. I'll get to that when we get it. A reprieve is a suspension of a death sentence. So we're never cured. I will always have this problem, because if I ingested the substances that caused me cravings, I would have the cravings again. And that would reduce it, yes.
So I would just want to ask if they understand the difference.
Oh, the difference between cured and recovered, yes. Yes.
And if you go take the old 12 on the front page, you are recovered.
Yes. So it's
recovered. So
it says cured. Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's all, but not that you aren't cured, then you're curing.
You're in the process of curing.
No. Yeah. If you take 12, the old book 12 and 12 on the front side, that's all you at the anyway.
Okay. Anonymous.
Yeah. Actually, came to preach that
you're cured. They said you're cured.
If you stay away from the first beer or drink the first drink, you are cured.
Well, the big book makes a distinction between cured and recovered and recovering. So I can only tell you in English, the original, cured means you no longer have the problem at all. If that were true, I wouldn't work the steps anymore. I'd be cured.
Okay.
You know, I have to work the steps to keep recovering. Yes, I understand that. I'm just saying, in English, the words do mean something different. Cured means you no longer have the problem at all. Recovered means you have the problem, but it is away from you today.
It is away,
and you
steps.
Yes. So anyway, I just point that out. Anyway, they have solved the drink problem. It means they found a solution to it. But the solution involves keeping in the program. It doesn't mean getting out of it. They talk about being average Americans, and it's like they've been rescued from a shipwreck, and it doesn't matter whether you're in the first class or in the steerage of the boat. You're all happy, and you hug each other because you've all survived. But they say that doesn't keep us together. What keeps us together, they say, and this is page 17 at the bottom and paragraph 3 of page 40 of the Danish version. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, the steps. We have a way out of our problem, which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Part of our recovery comes from helping others, and therefore we join together to help others. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to be a group of friendly people happy that they've recovered. It is to carry the message to others. That's what Tradition 5 is all about. I'm skipping over it now to page 20, which is page 42 in the Danish version, paragraph 3. You may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. So that's the big, all of us big book people say, do what we did, you'll have what we have. And that's what this book says. Before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. And Joe and Charlie really point out that so often in AA, that's what they say, and I know in OA, we start with, well, steps one and two, you know, let's just do step three and go on with it. And that's how I sponsored in my days of relapse. and how important it is to read these and to understand them. We have to take ourselves seriously. We don't take ourselves seriously in OA. I know that. It's not life or death for so many of us. And for me, it is. But I know that we sort of don't treat it as seriously as we treat alcoholism or as we treat Narcotics Anonymous. Those are the sexy addictions, and we don't have the, you know, we're embarrassed to say that we're members of OA because it's not prestigious to be a member. But, you know, if you go back to the days of before AA, you look at the old movies, the cinemas, and you'll see that the butt of the jokes was the drunk. They were so much. Charlie Chaplin, you know, one of the greatest comedians who ever lived, made a 20-minute short called, I think it's called 2 a.m. It might be 1 a.m. 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. And it's a drunk, millionaire drunk coming home to his mansion. And it is one of the most amazing pieces of comedy you'll ever see. He goes through about 20 minutes of teetering over the edge. You know, he's almost about to fall, and then he doesn't fall over a big staircase. He climbs up what he thinks is stairs. It's really a ladder, and then the ladder goes backwards. You know, all these amazing things that happen. And it would be hilarious, really funny, if he weren't a drunk. You know, but the fact that he's a drunk means that I can't watch it I can't laugh at it. But it was very funny when he did it, because drunks were the butt of the jokes, just as fat people are the people with eating problems are the butt of jokes today. It's our job to make it serious. And it's our job to be able to explain how serious it is. We are going to die badly if we keep on with our compulsive eating. Whether it's undereating or overeating, our bodies will gradually deteriorate and we will become dependent upon other people and more dependent. And our deaths will be slow, painful, humiliating, and tragic. You know, I have a few friends who have died of this illness. I have a friend who has recovered, lost a lot of weight, kept it off for years, and he often ends up sponsoring really, really heavy people because of how much weight he's lost. And he's told me about two people he sponsored who couldn't get it, and they both died. They weighed 500 to 800 pounds. Someone helped me with the kilo. It's 300 or 400 kilos. One of them died because he was in a fire in his house and they couldn't get him out. You know, luckily I stopped before I became that fat. But, you know, it is that, or the people who undereat are the people who waste away. Whatever, we're going to lose our faculties, we will lose our minds, and we've got to start treating this seriously. It certainly is a serious medical problem all through the world. The big book goes on, and it talks about what the definition of the real alcoholic is. On page 20 at the bottom, or page 43 of the Dana's edition, paragraph 2. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? So the real alcoholic is neither the moderate drinker nor the hard drinker. They say he may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. So you can have an alcoholic who is not a hard drinker, who can be a moderate drinker. What's the definition? At some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. So the first definition of the alcoholic, as it should be in the big book, at least from the big book, of the compulsive eater, is a person who can't stop once started, who loses control at certain times and can't stop, even though the mind might be saying, I must stop. That's the definition of the big book, and it's one that helps me understand my compulsive eating. It explains half of the problems I had in my life, that of the hand coming to the mouth and the mind saying, the next bite I will stop. Just the next one. So that shows you that you cannot define an alcoholic by the amount, and you cannot define the compulsive eater by the amount. You define the compulsive eater as to whether or not he or she has an allergy of the body. Allergy meaning that the abnormal reaction comes of cravings. Page 22 in the middle, or page 44, paragraph 1 in the Danish version. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle, catastrophe, horrible happenings, with all of its attendant suffering, all the suffering that comes with it, all the suffering, humiliation that comes with it, why does he take that one drink? Why can't he stay in the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcohol... So, this is another thing. We're not experts. We don't have opinions on outside issues. I don't know why I get these cravings. I have my suspicions. I read some medical journals. Or I read some medical research. But that doesn't matter. And, you know, doctors will not accept this as a problem because they can't measure this craving. It's very hard to measure it. It's emotional, it's spiritual. Whatever it is, it's something that takes over me. I call it physical, not because I know it's absolutely physical, but because I know it's like blinking and like breathing and like the heart beating. I can't stop it. All the will in the world, I can't stop it. And therefore, it must be physical as opposed to mental, where I can, in some way, see a change in my mind. Does that make sense? So it's not worth arguing over whether it really and truly is physical. What is important is that we believe that it's physical. So we can point to it and say, that is what I can't do. We know what we can't eat. We know what we can't drink. We know what drugs we can't take. That's why the big book says we must believe that there's something physical, something abnormal about us. Because if we don't believe that, then we'll think that going to therapy or working the steps without being abstinent will somehow help us. That we can handle it all by just a spiritual mind issue. And that's clearly not true. Well, I say it's clear. In my experience, it's not true. They go on, they say, we know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, to his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense. Bodily? More. Mental? Okay, I can't stop you. Which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. And then on page 23, page 45 of the Danish edition, paragraph 2, come the most significant words that really start to explain what it is that the steps do for us. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility. They make some sense. But none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc, the chaos, the horrible things an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They seem to be reasonable, but ultimately they are not a solution. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious, this false reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually that he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady, this illness, has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game. An obsession is an idea that takes control of your mind to the exclusion of all other ideas. And that's what they're going to talk about, the mental obsession. The mind that takes control of you and blots out all the other thoughts that you have. Thoughts such as, this is bad for me, I must not eat it. It just blots it out, takes it away, and replaces it with the thought that somehow, someday, you will beat the game. On page 24, right at the top, beginning on page 46, paragraph 1, sort of in the middle of that paragraph. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful ability, desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. They go on in the italics. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, reasons that can't be seen, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, we are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer don't crowd into the mind to deter us, to stop us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted, replaced with the old threadbare idea that this time we'll handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. I never put my hand in a hot stove, and I'm sure it's the experience of many people in this room. Only once in my life did I ever put my tongue on the window of a car in minus 40 weather. Never did that again. It hurt. That makes sense to many of you? Yes. You know what I'm talking about, right? Those of you who don't, have never experienced cold weather as we experience in Canada, may not know that your tongue sticks to anything and you can't take it off without ripping off the skin of your tongue. I did that when I was 7 years old. I never did it again. But I've overeaten many, many times. And I've eaten the foods that I knew were my problem many, many times, and I never learned. This is the mental problem that we have is an illness that tells us we don't have an illness. That's really what it is. And ultimately, and sadly, it is aided, it's abetted, it's encouraged by almost every diet you will ever read. Even those given to you by nutritionists, which tell you once you've lost your weight or once you've gained it, either, you can have your foods back. You can eat in small quantities. I don't know any diet that I've ever seen in a magazine that tells me that once I lose my weight, I cannot have a little bit of ice cream again. You know? And some of the diets these days give you the ice cream in the middle. They say, you know, once a week you can have a little bit. You know, and even the popular weight loss program that I used to be a member of, now you have points and you can have your donuts and stuff like that, where before you couldn't. Well, it works for some people who need to know what a good measure of a portion is, but it could never work for me. Page 25, which is on page 47, the Danish version, paragraph 1, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there's a solution, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And someone once pointed out that to pick up something laid at your feet means you must kneel. We have found much of heaven, and we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed. I'll pick up this fourth dimension when we talk about step 11. The fourth dimension, I think, is the ability to act without thinking and knowing that your actions will be for the better good, for the better. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. You could read that, the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. There's an asterisk there. It sends you to the appendix on spiritual experience. I won't go to it, but I will say that in the Danish version, at any rate, there are three footnotes referring to that, and it just says, see this page or go to this chapter. In the English version, the first time the asterisk says, it says fully explained. And then the second time it appears, it says for amplification. And then the third time it says, please read appendix. So the appendix on spiritual experience was put in the second printing of the first edition of the big book in 1941. The first edition was limited to 5,000 copies. It took them 2 years to sell it. If you owned a copy of that first edition, it is worth in the hundreds and thousands of dollars, if not, depending on the quality, it might even be worth $1 million, because they're very rare. What they discovered after that first edition came out was that their stories had all been about people who had the white light experiences. All of them were people who had found a God suddenly. You know, who are you to say there is no God? Bang, there's a God. You know, if there is a God, let him show me now. Bang, there's a God. In the United States and Canada, we have all these evangelical preachers who will hit you on the forehead and heal you. Heal, you know, that kind of thing. And that's the kind of experience that all these people talked about. And people were saying, I haven't had a drink for a long time. I don't want to drink. I feel as if I've recovered. And yet, I haven't yet been hit in the head by God. You know, I mean, really. So they wrote this appendix. They did two things. One is they wrote this appendix that said, no, it doesn't have to happen suddenly. As a matter of fact, most of us, it happens slowly. In Bill's story, it says, most men come to God gradually, but for me it was sudden. But all the experiences were sudden, you see. So they wrote this appendix to say that it was, it could be very slow. It could be a gradual thing. They talk about it happening within months as opposed to years. But not that it is necessarily this sudden belief in a God or even a long belief in a God. I've been abstinent and I've had my spiritual awakening, but I've never believed in a God. I don't have to. I can believe in a God of my own understanding, which is completely unlike any God that would be called God in the normal world. But I don't have this belief. I'll talk about that in a few, probably after lunch. So that appendix was put in. And the other thing they did was they changed step 12. It used to say having had a spiritual experience as the result of these steps. It now says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So the awakening is the gradual and the experience is the sudden. So they made those two changes to make sure that people realized that they could have a spiritual awakening without having the sudden experience that the people in the big book had. So that's the main reason for looking at that appendix. On page 26, also on page 47, paragraph 4 of the Danish version, there is a reference to a certain American businessman. In the history of AA, this is a wonderful story, so I'm going to tell it even though I don't really have the time to tell it. In 1931, although there's some argument as to maybe it might have been earlier and then came back, but anyway, approximately 1931, a very wealthy family sent one of their sons to Europe because he was an incurable drunk. And they sent him to Sigmund Freud to be psychoanalyzed, hoping that that might cure him. Well, Freud was evidently very busy, and he sent him to his disciple Alfred Adler, who, I can't remember, he was either busy or something else. So Roland Hazard was the name of this man. Roland went, these guys have wonderful names. Roland went to Carl Jung in Zurich. Carl Jung had broken with Freud over issues of, relating to spirituality. And he went through psychoanalysis with Carl Jung. And regardless of what anyone believes about any of these psychiatrists or psychoanalysts, they were clearly great therapists in and of themselves as individuals. Well, there are some issues with Freud, but at any rate, they were clearly people who could put you through. There are a lot of issues with Carl Jung, too. But anyway, he left Carl Jung thinking that he had understood himself so well that he would never drink again, and he got drunk either on the train going back to the port or on the ship going back to the United States. He went back to see Carl Jung, and he said, I'm drunk again. And Carl Jung said, I can't help you. You're incurable. On page 27 of the big book, page 48, paragraph 5 of the Danish version, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. I can't explain them. I don't know. They just happen. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Excuse me. That is, the the emotions, from Jung's point of view, these are emotions, are completely changed around. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly, it is not our experience, could be slow, suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Roland said, well, I'm the deacon of my church. I'm very active in my church. I believe in God. And Jung said, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a vital spiritual experience. And Roland went back to the United States, and he discovered a group called the Oxford Groups. The Oxford Groups had been founded in the early 1900s by a man named Frank Buckman. Frank Buckman, I sure hope that's his name. I'm sure that's his name. He had his history was kind of interesting. He used to be a minister in a Presbyterian church in Pennsylvania somewhere. And he got very angry at them, and they got very angry at him, and they had large words, big words, and he left them. I was going to say left them in a huff, and then he took a ship, too. He had to use the huff, and then he used the ship. But that's a joke, but it doesn't, not a very good joke, I guess. Obviously a very bad joke, So he went to Oxford, England, not to study at Oxford University, but just because it was a place where he could contemplate and think about things. He began to realize that he had lost his passion for God. And that was really at the heart of his problem, that it wasn't what his church had done. It was that he himself had lost his passion, and he was living a hypocritical life. He wrote a letter of apology to the church, apologizing to them for the grief that he had caused them because he had lost his own passion. And he discovered that he regained his passion. So he started to figure out what had happened to him. He began to study some more, and he developed some very simple techniques for regaining the passion for Christ. You get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make up for the wrongs you've done, you pray to God for guidance in all things, and you help others with the hope of reward, property, and prestige. And a group of people began to gather around him, calling themselves the Oxford Group, after where he had started this. It became very popular in the United States, very popular. They would go to cities and towns and hold big meetings of business people, businessmen, you know, very few business women in those days, and ministers, and try to reawaken passion for Christianity and for Christ. They called themselves first century Christians because they wanted to be like the first disciples, like the people who were carrying the word with passion and vigor. They would send them back to the churches. They weren't a church in and of themselves. They were a movement of people, a group of people who were trying to the Oxford Movement is in the Catholic Church, but they were a group of people who were trying to reawaken the passion. Well, Roland found the Oxford groups, and he got honest with himself, and he got honest with another human being, and he made up for the wrongs he had done, and he prayed to God for guidance in all things, and he tried to help others with hope, without hope of reward, property, or prestige. One day, two people came to him, and he stopped drinking. That's important, he stopped drinking. And one day, two other members of the Oxford groups came to him. I love their names, Shep and Zebra. These are not names you normally encounter. Often in the United States in those days, I think people were named after were given the first names of their mother's last name. I think that's what it was, but I'm not sure. Anyway, Shep and Zebra had been speaking to a person in a small town in Vermont. And this person had been sent to the summer mansion of a wealthy family. He was a hopeless drunk. He got so hopeless that they'd asked him to paint the house. Maybe that would get him sober. He painted the house, and some pigeon, you know, made a little mess on the house, on the paint. So he got out a shotgun and shot the whole side of the house to try and get the pigeon. He got into a car, and he drove right through the wall of another house into the kitchen and got out of the car and asked for a cup of coffee. Well, he was immediately arrested, and he was about to be put into an insane asylum, a mental institution for alcoholic insanity, by a judge who was the father of one of these two men, Zebra, I think. And they had been talking to him about the Oxford groups, but they weren't drinkers. So they went to Roland and said, "We know your experience. You stopped drinking as a result of this. Could you speak to my father, the judge, and tell him that he can come under your care and custody and that you'll try and help him get sober?" And he did. So, and that was Ebby Thatcher, Bill's friend. So Ebby got honest with himself, got honest with another human being, made up for the wrongs he had done, prayed to God for guidance in all things, and looked around for people he could help, and thought of Bill. So he went to see Bill, and we had that meeting that I described earlier across the kitchen table. Now, Bill had one piece of information that Ebby did not have, and that was the reason for his problem. Bill knew that his problem was that once he started, he couldn't stop, but that his real problem was in the mind, that he couldn't stop from starting. And Bill realized, as he worked these five suggestions, that they changed his mind. See, remember, Carl Jung said you have to change your mind. You have to have this spiritual experience. Bill knew why he needed a spiritual experience, because he knew that his mind had to be changed, because if it wasn't, he'd continue to go back to drinking. So Bill ended up with the equivalent of six steps. You're powerless. And because you're powerless, you get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make up for the wrongs you've done, you pray to God for guidance in all things, and you help others without hope of reward, property, or prestige. Bill brought it all together, six steps. And we'll see as we go into the history of AA how those six steps became 12 steps. I find it so interesting. Bill wrote to Carl Jung just before Carl Jung died, and he to thank him for the role that he played in the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the first version, the first printing of the big book, they never mentioned Dr. Jung's name as they do now. And he wrote to Carl Jung and he thanked him and gave him some of the history of what had happened. And Carl Jung wrote back to him a letter which Lois framed and put on the wall of their home. And in the pictures that I sent around, you might have seen a little plaque with a letter. That's Carl Jung's letter. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just read a part of it that I think is really significant. It's a wonderful letter. You can get it on the internet, copy on the internet, or you can buy an AA book called The Language of the Heart, which is a wonderful collection of Bill's writings. I'm telling you, they're incredible. He has written some great essays on many different things, but it contains this letter. He says, that Roland's craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness or God. So easy for us to translate, we have a hunger for God. And we fill that hunger with food instead of with God. That was his analysis of Roland's problem. A spiritual thirst. And he says, the only way you can have that, he says there are two ways to find a spiritual answer. One is through an experience, God talking to you or people talking to you through God, an act of grace or a miracle occurring to you, or through a higher education of your mind, through beyond the confines of mere rationalism. You have to go outside of logic and rationalism and find and study and find a God that way. And he says, clearly Roland tried that way, and it was obviously the better way. And he says, there is evil in this world. This is where Jung becomes a little bit not quite scientific. He says, there's evil in this world. And if we don't recognize the spiritual thirst for wholeness, it will lead us into hell. If we don't have either real religious insight, a spiritual awakening, or the protective wall of human community. And you see, what all these 12-step fellowships give us, like OA, is the combination of spiritual insight and the protective wall of human community. That's why it's so powerful, because we have both of the things that Carl Jung says you can have one of or the other of. So I find that to be very, very powerful concept, is that at the same time that we're working through our spiritual growth and we're finding our God through the steps, we are also protected by the common humanity within our program. We are part of something and part of a fellowship that gives us that protection while we're working the steps. And when we work the steps, we find our spiritual thirst for wholeness quenched not by alcohol, or our spiritual hunger for wholeness not quenched by food, but quenched by our concept of God, our higher power. Very powerful. Well, I think it's powerful. The next chapter of the big book is devoted entirely to explaining the mental obsession. I've already talked a lot about it, so I want to just read certain passages from it. This is chapter 3, more about alcoholism, page 30 in the big book and page 51 in the Danish version. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. Remember, the definition of real is not necessarily a hard drinker or a moderate drinker. It's the person who can't stop once he starts and who can't stop from starting. No person likes to think he is bodily, can't stop once you start, and mentally, can't stop from starting, different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain, hopeless attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The obsession is that I can eat one bite of this food and love it and be so happy with that one bite and not want any more. Control and enjoy. I can have only a limited amount and still enjoy it. Never happened to me. I've never been able to control and enjoy. If I wanted that food, if that food was one of my binge foods, having only a little bit kept me wanting more and I couldn't enjoy myself. I'd get this feeling, it would feel good, I'd feel great, and then it would drop down, I'd want some more because I wanted to feel great again. And of course, it was all short-lived. It always got worse. I wanted more and more and more because I kept looking for that experience again, and I couldn't get it. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Violent words here. There's words used, death threats, basically, a lot of death threats here. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. but all of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably always followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man and woman that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. And they say, okay, you might not be convinced of that. Try this. Try controlled drinking. Go to a bar and just have one drink and see if you can stand it. And the threat, and I, you know, people who say to me, I don't have a physical problem, I say to them, fine, name your binge food and have only one of them. If you can do it, you may not be one of us. You may not have that physical problem. If you have that kind of control and you don't continue to eat, you may not be a candidate for Overeaters Anonymous. That's one test. And then they say, then they give the example of a man of 30 who was drinking a lot, and he realized he would never get anywhere if he drank, so he stopped drinking for 25 years. He was able to retire at the age of 55, which is pretty good for the depression years. Out come the pipe, out come the slippers, and out comes the bottle. And within 4 years, he dies of alcohol-related death. They say on page 33 of the big book, and page 53, paragraph 2 of the Danish version, commencing to drink after a period of, it's in the middle, commencing to drink, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in a short time as bad as ever. If we're planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking, that means hidden notion, that someday we will be immune to alcohol. The next two paragraphs I commend to you if you find the big book to be non-inclusive, if you find it to be all about men. They talk about young people and they talk about women. And they invite young people, women, to consider themselves as to whether they are alcoholics or not. It's their attempt to be all-inclusive, even though they wrote from their own perspective, which was men. On page 34, where's their other test? Oh, they have another test. Yes, another test. If the body, the first test was try one glass of beer. Try one portion of your trigger food. That's testing your body. Is your body going to want more? If it does, you're probably a compulsive eater. Then they give another test. Stay away from it for a year. See if you can do that. That's testing your mind. You know, if your body and your mind neither passes the test, you probably have the problem. And then they go into three examples to analyze the thinking that goes into the mind of the alcoholic who takes what they call the desperate experiment of the first drink. I love that phrase, the desperate experiment of the first bite. So what is he thinking? So they give a number of examples. The first example they call Jim. Actually somewhere I can tell you what his real name is. It doesn't really matter. He used to own a car agency. His family owned it, and then he lost it, and now he's working for someone else in that same car agency. So he's full of resentment. He's not happy. He doesn't work the program. They work with him, and he does some nice things, and he stops drinking, but he's not really growing spiritually. He's not doing all of his steps. He comes and he gets drunk. So he tells a story about coming to work one day, having some words with his boss, not very happy. He used to own the place. He no longer owns it. He decides to go into the countryside to look for someone he might sell a car to. He stops at a restaurant. It's all sane, all reasonable things. Stops at a restaurant where he stopped before. He orders a glass of milk and a sandwich, and no problems. He orders another glass of milk and another sandwich. And suddenly the thought crosses his mind that he could, if he put liquor in his milk, it couldn't hurt him on a full stomach. And he gets drunk. And right at the bottom of page 36, paragraph 4 of page 56 of the Danish version, right in italics, he had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be be called anything else. And you've heard the definition. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. They say, you may think this an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences. And here's a difficult sentence. I want to go through it. There is always the curious mental phenomenon, the occurrence for which there is no explanation, that, parallel with our sound reason, there always ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. So imagine, well, I don't know if you ever watched Disney cartoons, and they often used to have in the old days the angel and the devil on either shoulder, you know, Mickey Mouse, you know, don't take it, don't take it, don't take it. Yes, take it, you know, that stuff. And the idea here is parallel, there are two paths, you know. On the one side is, don't take it. This is bad for you. Once you start, you won't be able to stop. Remember, every other time you've ever had this, once you started, you couldn't stop. Now you've been off it for 6 months. You've been really good. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. That's the angel. The devil on the other side, you know what the devil is saying? I think in the end, the devil is just saying, oh, come on. He's not saying anything more than that. It's coming up with excuses, and I can give you a whole list of them. But in the end, that's what the devil is saying. You can have it. Okay. He said, no, 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 okay. You know, just okay. And it's really that simple. And that is the mind problem. I have a list that I once drew up of excuses. I gave you a whole bunch of them yesterday, but I'm standing up, it doesn't count. It used to be a really good excuse for me. I don't know. I've been very good for a year, a month, an hour, you know, that one. I didn't eat the bun. I didn't eat the last, the last serving. I didn't have a second helping so I can have the cake. I'm so depressed. What will make me feel better? I'm so happy. How can I celebrate? I mean, look at those two things and realize how ridiculous that is. And yet, I've had both. They made it especially for me. How can I refuse? I'll never be able to have this food again. You know, the chef just died and didn't leave the recipe. Or I'm in this part of town, which I'll never be in again, and this is a special restaurant. Here's one that I think people ought to think about more. It's stone ground whole grain cinnamon bun made with organic molasses and cold pressed organic oil. It's got to be good for me. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's because it's organic, it's got to be good. Organic milk, organic cream, organic butter. You know, the cows didn't suffer when we got this butter. She's not looking, so it doesn't count. That was a good one for me. I have to taste it to see if it's okay. No one loves me. I mean, I've had those feelings. No one loves me. I've also had the other feeling. Too many people love me. And both of them were excuses to eat. Overeating will kill me, but it's a nice way to commit suicide. I told you this one yesterday. My spouse won't feel guilty when I die. How will I fit in? At least people can see what my weakness was. I was somehow proud. You know, I have my one weakness and people can see what it is. You know, it's obvious what my weakness is. I'm sure you can add to those excuses. But whatever they are the equivalent of, come on. Because they're all stupid excuses. They're just bad excuses. They're just, you grab the excuse in order to fit the occasion. It's not as if they're real excuses, because you know it's going to get worse, not better. And that's what the big book is saying. They say, in some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately. This is on page 37 and paragraph 3 on page 57 of the Danish version. In some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we're obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific here means horrible, consequences might be. They give you two other examples. The jaywalker, a jaywalker is a person who walks against traffic. It doesn't happen in Copenhagen, I understand, but certainly happens in other parts of the world. He just walks across the traffic, and he keeps getting hit, and he says, I'll swear off it, I won't do it, he keeps getting hit again, and he goes to an institution and finally gets out, and he jaywalks again. They say, you may think this is crazy and absurd, but if you substitute the word alcoholic or compulsive eater for jaywalker, you'd have the same result. You do things, you keep banging yourself in the head and thinking you'll feel better. And then they say, well, maybe now that I, you may be saying, well, now that I know I can't have a drink, that's good enough. Self-knowledge will work. And they use an example of Fred, who has a wonderful day, has been sober, he doesn't do the steps, but he knows he can't drink, has a wonderful day, and he walks into a hotel room where he's staying, into the dining room, and the thought, this is on page 41, page 60, paragraph 3 of the Danish version, as I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails for dinner. Had a good day. So the big book's explanation, description, ranges from having a bad day to having a good day to having an insane day to figuring out that if you've been away from it for a long time, you can have it again. It's all the obsession of the mind that you think you can control and enjoy your compulsive eating. If you understand that you have that mind, if you do have that mind, and you also have a body that once you start you can't stop, then you are in a vicious circle. If you can't stop once you've started, because your body wants more, 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 and you can't stop yourself from starting because your mind keeps saying, come on, you can have it, then you'll always go back and forth between compulsive eating and dieting. Which is my story. That's the explanation for all what's called yo-yo dieting. I don't know if that phrase means anything to you, but you know, it's just up and down, up and down, up and down. And for me, it always got worse. It never got better. I always gained more weight than I lost. So this is the dilemma, the double whammy that Dr. Silkworth called, the dilemma of the addict, of every addict. If you believe that you have a physical allergy, that you get a reaction that says your body wants more and it will not stop until it gets more, and you have a mind that can't protect yourself from eating the things or from taking the things that cause you that, then you're doomed. And if you're doomed, then you have no hope in yourself. And now we come, and I'll discuss this after the break and after the OA meeting comes after the break. The only hope comes in a spiritual solution. The only hope comes from outside of yourself. And that then comes the problem of God, which many of you may have that problem with, and I'll discuss that later as well. But if we don't understand step one, and it's really just understanding. We don't understand how desperate we are, that we will never get out of this, that our fate is death and a horrible death, and it's slow, very slow. You know, it's not as dramatic as so many other addictions, but that's our fate. If you don't take it that seriously and understand that it may not be bad for you now, but it's going to get worse and worse and worse if you exhibit those same symptoms. If you can't learn from our longer experience with eating, and if I can't learn from those who have reached 800 pounds or 300 kilos or whatever, 400 kilos, then this program is not going to be for you, because you won't take it seriously enough to do all the things that are required of you. That's why we spend a lot of time, that's why I learned from Joe and Charlie to spend a lot of time on step one. So I'm 3 minutes over, and I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. Thanks.